Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At the height of the counterculture, anti-war movement of the 1960s and 70s, the musical backdrop of millions of young American lives was made by the iconic group Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, with songs like Ohio, Wooden Ships, Woodstock, and Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. In the years since, a lot of music and headlines have been made by the group's flamboyant composer, singer, and guitarist David Crosby, for jail time, for fathering Melissa Etheridge's children and discovering his own, for hitting the road well into his 60s to raise the anti-war banner again. Up next on Point, a conversation with musical icon David Crosby on life, music, and America, then and now. Joining me now from New York City is the two-time inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, legendary singer, songwriter, and guitarist David Crosby. He's a founding member of the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Last summer, he toured with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's 2006 Freedom of Speech Tour, and he plays in a new band, CPR, with his son, James Raymond. He's out this month with a 3-CD set called Voyage, covering nearly 5 decades of his music, and with a new memoir, his second, titled Since Then, How I Survived Everything and Lived to Tell About It. David Crosby, welcome. Great to have you.
Thanks, man.
What's it like touring at 65?
It's fun. I can't help giggling when you call me a legend. That just cracks me up. But, it doesn't feel like that. I put my pants on same as you do, one leg at a time. And I just never felt like a legend. But if you say so.
I think we do. Your voice doesn't sound, it sounds like 25.
Is
the rest
amazing,
of you as good looking as your voice?
No, it's really not. I'm kind of amazed I still have a voice after everything that's gone on. But it's still there, and I'm still able to sing, which means I still have a job, which is truly a wondrous thing.
What do you feel coming back in the summer of 2006? You were all over the place as a war was going on, the war in Iraq, with the same guys you were touring with when the Vietnam War was on. What do you feel reflecting back from the crowds, the country, now that you did or did not then?
Well, the similarities are obvious. The country was heavily polarized then, and it's heavily polarized now. It was over a war that many of us felt was unjust, or worse yet, was over profit rather than principle. The similarities are amazing. There are several differences. You don't see the kind center to the resistance movement that the college campuses were back then, mm-hmm. because there's no draft.
And so not everybody has skin in the game.
Yeah, exactly. Now, mind you, I'm hoping and praying that they don't, put in a draft, because then I have to think about my 11-year-old boy and mm-hmm. start figuring out whether I want to be an Italian or a Canadian or mm-hmm. Costa Rican. But they can't have my boy, that's for sure.
Not going to happen. And when you're on stage with the crowd, as you look out, is it the crowd you've brought along from 1969, 1973? Is it a young crowd? Is it both?
It's both. Yeah, it's both. And it was an amazing thing because, we're kind of this band of weirdos, man. In the first place, we're patriots. We
legends
really
is the word we use here. Legends.
No. Let's not use legends.
All right. Weirdos.
But we're patriots when it comes to the country. We love this country and we believe in it. And so we think it's worth fighting for. So to go out last summer and once again, feel like we were, fighting the good fight, it made us believe in ourselves again. It made us that attitude infected all of our playing and all of the concert. It was a natural, take these songs that Neil had written, mm-hmm. very direct, in your face, you know, let's impeach the president for lying.
Yes.
That was fun every night. And you mix those with Long Time Gone and For What It's Worth and Ohio and so forth, and it works. It's the right context. So it was an amazing summer. Amazing summer. We hopefully we did cause some trouble.
You know, other groups, Dixie Chicks famously, have paid and paid famously for being critical of the president. I wonder if you feel inoculated against that kind of backlash, because that's been your posture all along. I mean, you talk about a chimpanzee in the White House, and never mind impeach the president. I mean, that's sort of straight in the president's face. But are you inoculated because you've always been on the counterculture shore?
I don't know. Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Do you think it should be a law that you can't have control of nuclear weapons unless you can pronounce the word nuclear?
Well, I come from a part of the country where lots of people say nuclear. So I don't know.
Well, then it's an indefensible position. I'm sorry. What did you ask me?
Well, just if you feel kind of shielded because you've been in the counterculture for a long time, because others have been just blasted, and here you are flying on.
No, we got blasted plenty.
Yeah.
We got adverse articles and reviews, some of them, although I would say 98% were very much favorable. We got the same thing in the audiences. There'd be, you know, out of 20,000 people, there'd be 8 that were really ticked off that mm-hmm. You can't say that about George. Stop mm-hmm. that. And they'd shake their fist at us and walk out. But truthfully, I think we were the right thing at the right time this summer again, and I hope we go ahead and do it next summer.
We want to talk about a lot more music, but we want to get plugged into your life as well. Second memoir out with Carl Gottlieb again. 2 memoirs? I mean, we know you've had a rich life, but what, you looked around and there was such a barge load of news that we need another one.
Yes. Yeah. We had written the first one. I had gone through all this stuff, you know.
A year in jail in Texas for drugs and all the rest.
Yeah, a year in prison in Texas, and you know, I thought, it's a pretty interesting life. Let's write it down. It's a bit of a cautionary tale, but, you know, it's kind of a love story, too. It's a good adventure. Let's write it down. So then, no sooner do I get that out than along comes, you know, Hep C, and I nearly die, have a transplant, find my son James, get reunited with him, the whole Melissa thing. All these other things happen that were, just too good, to leave out. And so we wrote a part 2.
Let's tell the story again. Begin to take us into that. Let's start with Django, your son. I mean, he's 11 years old. Now, you're 65. Jan's right there. And I guess if you hadn't survived the liver transplant, we'd be singing a different song or none.
Yes. The liver transplant actually happened in time for me to see Django get born. Mm-hmm. And if it had not happened, I would not have seen him get born, which would have been a real shame. He's a wonderful kid.
But not the only child in your life. You also had James Raymond come back into your life. How did that happen? This was a boy you had not ever known.
I knew he was out there, and I worried about it for 30 years.
Who was his mom?
His mom was a lady that I was with back many, many years ago.
18, and, 19?
Yeah, way back there.
Yeah.
1900 and frozen to death. And his parents, who raised him, wrote me a letter when I was in the hospital.
He was put up for adoption, yeah.
Yeah, he was put up for adoption by his mom, and probably rightly so. Neither she nor I could have raised a kid back then. And he came and met me, and he was the kindest, most generous soul you could imagine. He brought no baggage with him at all. He gave me a clean slate. He gave me a chance. And that was an incredibly kind thing for him to do. He's a wonderful young man.
You play music with him now. What's that like? Can you feel the blood tie?
I absolutely can. I know where he's going next, and he knows where I'm going next. And it happens all the time when we play together.
And you say he gave you a great gift because you were sitting there in fear in the hospital, worrying that he would, well, he could have come after you with all kinds of emotion. It's easy to imagine.
It very often goes that way. When parents and children who have been separated that way get reunited or get to meet each other, they very often find out that the reality does not match their expectation or their dream, and that the person, you know, the guy that they thought was a hero is some drunk living in a trailer. It happens. It could have happened with us. If James had met me 10 years earlier or 12, 15 years earlier, he wouldn't have even wanted to talk to me. You know, it was, we were very, very fortunate that it went down the way it did. Because now, you know, we're very close and we write a lot of music together, which is some of the best stuff I've ever written in my life. Mm.
David Crosby, as you say, we don't have an anti-war movement now as we had then. Why not?
You know, I think that the largest thing is what we said earlier is that there is no draft. And that means that we don't have the college campuses of the country being hotbeds of political activity.
Does that mean Americans, it wasn't moral opposition then? It was just cover my
hinder? It was moral opposition, but it was very immediate if you were going. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it had a lot to do with it. And the facts sort of tend to bear me out. I think, however, that they may be, the they in question being Shrub and Company, I think they may be dumb enough to put in a draft, and in which case they'll see a lot more activism against the war. The war is definitely not a popular idea. War is a dumb way to solve problems in the first place, and this particular war is already, you know, very unpopular. This last election was heavily exit polled because nobody trusted the machines, and rightly so. So it was heavily exit polled, and it, according to my sources, it was almost a one issue sweep. It was based, you know, people said basically not even on the economy, which is certainly on the toilet, but on the war. They do not think that we should be out there adventuring around trying to play the world's policeman and going stomping into places and acting like a bull in a china shop without having ever read the history of the place, apparently, how they could possibly not have understood that there was a three-way war going on there in the first place. And that it had been going on for hundreds of years, and that if we stepped in the middle of it, it wasn't going to solve anything.
Did you think in 1969 or 72 or 73 at Woodstock or after, did you think that your generation would change the human pattern of going to war in a profound way? I mean, here we are. It's your generation, essentially, that's in power, that's in charge, and we're in a war. Is that a surprise to you?
I don't know if it's really our generation that changed that perception, or if it was being able to see it on TV with Walter Cronkite. That was a very, very big deal. Now, you know, they manage that much more carefully now. You can't see the bodies coming home. You can't. There's no footage ever of any American troop wounded or killed. Never is not allowed. Our supposedly free press is not allowed to show you anybody getting hurt from our side, ever. And they can't show you the bodies coming home either, because they want to deny that that's what the price is for this kind of adventuring. It's a much better managed war.
But I guess my question is this.
In terms of publicity.
But it's your generation who's doing that managing, that's in charge now in the White House.
No,
come on. I mean, people at 65, that's kind of the height of
a lot of political power.
People
are much older than I am, aren't they?
I'm sure they are, though the calendar wouldn't show it.
I can't take responsibility for that part of my generation. They didn't graduate from the School of Peace and Love, I think.
Did you ever think it would turn out that way? Did you think that the Peace and Love School was going to own the future?
I really had no idea that any of this world would turn out the way it's turning out, and we haven't seen how it's going to turn out yet. But it is amazing the way things are really in this country right now. It's just the actual country, the basic idea of this country is under attack, you know, to the point where we may lose it. I could read you off a credible scenario where we would actually blow the United States apart in the near future, which would be really grim because it's a great place.
David Crosby's with us. You can hear the fire still burning right there. A lot of listeners want to join us as well. Let's go to Scott in Plainfield, Connecticut. Scott, you're on the air with David Crosby.
Hey, David Crosby, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Hi, Scott.
Good, good. Hey, I just want to say that I saw you play this summer over in Uncasville, and I must admit, it's, you know, seeing your show was so entertaining, and it also helped me look at the war from like a total different perspective, very reminiscent of the Vietnam era, even though I was born in 1969.
Well, thanks. I'm glad it did.
Yeah, well, you know, Dave, it seems like more people like my age, the 30-somethings, we need to take more of this weight by voting and getting our voices out, and a lot of people ain't doing that.
Well, they really do need to. This democracy doesn't work unless it has an electorate that's willing to participate. If we don't have that, we don't have any of it. None of it works.
Yeah, it almost seems like it's just taken for granted, and it's just a shame. But like I said, I'd like to thank you for that wonderful evening, and facts don't lie.
Scott, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another from Jeffrey in Boston. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. And kudos to you, Tom. You're once again showing how versatile you are at this business.
We've got a legend here. We've got a legend here.
Here it comes again.
Here it comes.
But I really appreciate you bringing David Crosby on. And for you, David Crosby, thank you for all this great music, all these wonderful years. Tom, to answer your questions, do I miss the counterculture? Absolutely. Do we need the counterculture in the politics? Absolutely. And I have two quick comments/questions for David Crosby.
Yeah.
First of all, one of the great underappreciated albums at the time, CD now, was If I Could Only Remember My Name, David Crosby. And I wonder if you remember that and the stunning array of musicians that you had on that album, which was really mind-boggling as I look at the liner notes yet again. And I see also that you have a reissue of that with the DVD, which is very exciting. My question on that was whether there's ever been a thought of gathering whoever is left from that incredible crowd to do a follow-up bit of music. And the second question is, and then I'll take this off air to hear your answer, is I'm very interested in how counterculture and politics can intermingle and provide a very strong force for social change. And I know you're trying to do that. I'm wondering why we're not seeing more of it, and can there be more of an effort on the part of musicians like yourself to get other musicians to become more engaged? Mm.
Jeffrey, thanks so much.
Okay, the first question.
David Crosby.
The first question was,
are you going to get the band back together and the
whole
big group? Can you recreate that?
No, you can't. It's like trying to recreate Woodstock. No, you'll make something else, and it might be interesting, but it won't be that.
Remind us who was in on it the first time around.
It's a whole lot of people. Nash, Garcia were there almost every night. Mm-hmm. Phil Lesh, Greg Rolie, Jack Cassidy, Jorma Kalkinen.
Right on and on and on.
Mm. And on and on and on. So a whole lot of people who were there. Anyways, and the second question was?
The counterculture now, they keep coming back to it. But Jeffrey says, he thinks we still need it. Why isn't it rising up with the same vigor? Is it just the draft?
I think that's a large part of it, and it's a it's a sad but true thing. It would be different if there were a draft. You would see every campus would be a hotbed of anti-war activity, and as it is, some of them are, and you know there should be more. This war is a pretty grim thing, you know. In the first place, who gets killed? 100 to 1 innocent people in every war since we've been writing them down. Innocent people get killed rather than the people who start the war in particular or the people who fight the war. Innocent people get killed for no reason. And, you know, you're talking about people in Iraq who had absolutely no say in what happened at all. You know, they've never had a say in anything that's been going on around them. It's hard for me to believe that we can't come up with a better solution.
When you look back on the 1960s and the counterculture then, what do you admire about it? What lasts and what's just as well behind
us? I liked its bravery. Mm-hmm. I liked its bravery. I liked its innocence, and I liked its insistence. I liked a whole lot of things about it. I think we were right about most of the things that we espoused as you know, value systems. We were right about, you know, peace being better than war, no question. We were right about human rights and women's rights and children's rights and gay rights and, you know, it, all people, the way it says in the documents that we base the country on is everybody's created equal, period. It didn't say except anybody. Mm. It says, you know, I think we were right. I think the only stuff we got wrong was about drugs, and we were supremely ignorant about the drugs, and so we walked right into that one, and it clocked us in the head. But all the other stuff, I think we were right about.
Let's take a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Robin, you're on the air with David Crosby.
Hi, thanks for bringing up this really important subject. I'd like to know how many of the people who are making the decisions about this war actually have loved ones in Iraq. And because of that, I'm thinking that reinstating the draft could be our best hope of ending the war sooner. You know, because everybody, and I mean everybody, would have to worry about their kids then being sent to Iraq.
And that would work if... That would work, except that there's what happens is you wind up with there being huge loopholes that people with enough money can go through to avoid the draft. Witness our president, who successfully avoided Vietnam.
I know, and they need to be in the mix with everybody else.
I think they should have to go. Personally, yeah. I think, you know, when a politician wants to start a war, he should have to pick up an M16 and lead the charge.
Exactly. And, you know,
I think that would cut down on some of this irresponsible behavior.
Yeah. When I think of lead the charge, though, I also think of the college campuses because they really did lead the charge back then. And I think if we had a draft again, they'd be right out there doing it again.
Robin, thanks very much for that. David, let me get a call from Brookfield, Massachusetts, if I may. Bob's on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you hear, Bob? What do you know?
Real quick things. A lot of the politics I wanted to talk about you've already covered. David, an amazing honor. You're just such a tremendous amount of respect for you. I saw you guys in Mansfield here, an amazing concert, and I just want to say that I really, in my heart, feel that your concert helped swing the election. I mean, the feeling I had at that concert felt that the commitment was deepening, and, you know, keep the, you know, as we all know, you have to keep going. Wanted to take it a little bit of a different direction.
Yeah.
A lot of that concert, I could sense, was Joni Mitchell's affect was part of all the music you and the group were playing that night. Wanted to see if you could talk about integrating some of these themes into your writing process and the muse. I know it's a little bit of a different direction, but maybe you could integrate it. And, again, thank you for your commitment to your art and its lasting influence. It continues to be a very sustaining part of my life. Thank you.
Thank you, man. I'm not quite sure what he asked.
Your muse, then and now. What gets it flowing for David Crosby?
Oh, geez. You know, I wish I could describe how it works. I find that very often it happens when I'm going to sleep. The busy mind, the verbal crystallization level that's talking to you right now goes to sleep, and some other level that makes longer leaps of connection, that's a more intuitive, imaginative level, gets a shot at the steering wheel for a minute just when I'm going to sleep. And all of a sudden I'll be writing lyrics. And it's a fascinating process because they'll come out largely already formed. So there's no sort of tab A, slot B kind of process. That's going on somewhere inside my head all the time because it comes out, you know, already thought out.
You keep a pad by the bedside and Jan knows,
exactly,
watch out,
yeah.
David's going to be hopping up now and then.
Yeah, it's a thing that a science fiction author that I like a lot told me, William Gibson. He says they call it the elves take over the workshop, and that all writers have a pad next to the bed for that exact reason.
Has it changed? Has what gets whispered in your ear changed over the years? Do you see a consistent theme or a very different tone to what you write more recently?
I don't know. You know, I've always written more about love than anything else. Always. And I think that's still true. The biggest change in my writing has been the effect of my son James. He and I have written a lot of songs in the last 10 years, and they are arguably some of the best stuff I've ever been involved with, ever. Some of the best songs I've ever written have been in this new batch of stuff with James. Just stunners.
Richard's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I just want to thank David for all the work he's done. As a veteran, I used to listen to his music when I was in the Air Force. I was a serviceman who was anti-war, and proud of that.
So hats all off there. And salute there from a vet in Hartford. Thanks very much for that.
Congratulations, man.
Let's go to Nashville.
That wasn't an easy thing to be a vet and to be anti-war. We had some very interesting times this summer, inviting young service guys, Marines and soldiers who were just coming back from Iraq to our shows, and asking them what they thought. You know, how did it make them feel?
Were they open to the invitation?
Oh yeah. They wrote some good songs too.
Wow. And there, right along with the rest of the crowd. Richard, thanks for that. Debbie's calling from Nashville. Debbie, you're on the air with David Crosby.
Hello, David. I'm honored to speak with you.
Hi, Debbie.
I saw you in concert in a small town, Tallahassee, Florida, in the 80s. It was an amazing evening, and you may not remember that, but the crowd was just stalwart in their support of you. And my comment is with respect to the war. I couldn't agree with you more in terms of the draft. But one of my concerns has been consistently that most of the people, and I've interviewed over 125 veterans, but most of the people that go into the war are actually, they're not college kids. They're people of lower socioeconomic status, and they've in a way been drafted by virtue of their economic status. And I just wanted,
that's true.
And I'll take my comments off the air, but I just wanted to know some more of your thoughts about the inequality with respect to socioeconomic status. And thank you again for the wonderful years of music. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, the way I see them, you're right, you know, about your analysis about who winds up in the modern-day Army, but the way I see them is as some of the best people we've got. They are some of the best young human beings, the ones with the courage, the ones who believe in their country enough to lay themselves on the line for it. I think they're some of the best we got. And I think to ask them to go and risk their lives for, you know, so companies like Exxon and Halliburton and Bechtel can make, you know, windfall profits, that doesn't work for me at all. Not with these young people. I think they're very brave, but I think we need better leadership to only use them when we really have to, and not when you need the company that owns your president wants to make a profit. Mm.
Debbie, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Chris in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I was seeing Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young the night that Nixon resigned.
Oh, okay.
And Graham Nash came to the microphone and said it, and you played 10 Soldiers and Nixon's Coming. It was a wonderful night, and I'm now thinking of a question as far as who's out there now writing songs for social change and social causes. I mean, Susan Warner and some other folk artists come to my mind, but does it damage your career? Is it a burden to do it now? Is it something that's just not being done by the new breed?
It's certainly not going to help your career. Witness the Dixie Chicks, who expressed themselves politically and suffered for it. But there are young people out there who are doing it and are writing and singing great songs. The one that leaps to my mind is this young pop girl, Pink.
Mm.
Pink, you know this girl, Pink?
Dear Mr. Yeah. President is her song.
Yeah, Dear Mr. President. If you Google it, I'll give you $100 if you can get all the way through without crying. It's an unbelievable song.
Well, I wish your address for the $100.
because I'll win. I wish I could have written this song. It's that good.
Yeah.
It's just a stunner.
with the Dixie Chicks, though, don't you think that because they were had a Southern-based audience, they were kind of in trouble anyway? I mean, if the comment had been...
They were in trouble. No, it was a very specific thing. It was a group of people who run a collection of radio stations, and they're called Clear Channel, and they own more radio stations than anybody else in the country and more billboards. And now they, through another subdivision, own most of the big venues in the country as well.
And when they decided Dixie Chicks were off, they were off.
Yeah, they pulled them off about 1,400 radio stations in one day.
That's...
So it's kind of a de facto censorship thing. Mm. It fortunately did not stop the Dixie Chicks. They are proceeding ahead full speed and doing a very good job of it.
Chris, thanks for your call. David Crosby, I want to hit some of the issues you've got in the memoir. I mean, it was action-packed enough last time, and there's a lot in this one as well. Some things people will have heard about but not really know the details of. I mean, one, famously, you were the father as sperm donor to Melissa Etheridge and her partner Julie Cypher. A couple of kids there. Why'd you do that?
My wife volunteered me.
Jan said, David, I got a job for you?
Yeah, kind of. We were in Hawaii, and Julie and Melissa were visiting one afternoon. And they were, you know, our kid Django is a very spectacular kid. You kind of look at him and you go, well, how do you get one like that? Because he's wonderful. And that exact thing was going on. And it was plain that there was a longing there. You know, that they really did want to have kids, and that it had been a real problem for them. As soon as you mention that you're a lesbian couple, things get very sticky, was what they told us. And so my wife volunteered me. And I think I was as surprised as they were. But there was love there, and I believe in that. I don't really care what the plumbing is on the people that are doing it. I care about is there love there in the first place. And there was. And so we took a chance. And I think it was, you know, something I do not regret at all. Because the kids are, you know, the proof is in the pudding. The kids are wonderful.
That's great. Great story. Let me get a call from Des Moines, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just had a couple comments. Just the best concerts I've ever seen were both Crosby, Stills, and Nash at Colorado Red Rocks. Once with the Colorado Symphony, and it was amazing. I guess I just wanted to say that, for me, it's just all about the music. I'm kind of pessimistic about music's influence on anything that happens politically. It's a refuge, I guess, but as far as any influence. I agree 100% with the political views of Mr. Crosby. That's where I stand. You're immortal. My kids sing your songs in the car. Our house is our favorite, and I just want to thank you for the music.
You're more than welcome, man.
Tom, thanks a lot. Thanks very much. Let's get another call from Baltimore. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air with David Crosby.
Right. Morning, Tom.
Hey.
Morning, David. Love your show.
Morning.
Been a fan since the 60s.
Thank you,
man. My question is, I would like your opinion on one of my opinions, that the main or one of the reasons that we're in Iraq now is because Bush Jr. wanted to do something that Bush Sr. didn't do. What do you think?
Oh, I think that's certainly a part of it. You know, we're not talking about a guy who is a statesman and does things for statesman-like reasons. He hadn't even been out of the country before he got to be president. He's lucky if he can find France on a map. Oh, don't get me started.
Okay, we'll take that. We'll take that. You know, the thing that I just can't let go of is this question. We hear from people who have followed you all these years who were inspired decades ago by your music, by the groups, by the message there. And still here we are, 40, 50 years later, back at war, and it's the generation that you were part of that is largely in charge now. Why do you think that happened? Does it mean that the counterculture message was never going to stick? Is it somehow not harmonious with something about America? How do you interpret it?
It means that we underestimated the greed for power. That's what it means. It means that the greed for power and dominion over other human beings is far more pervasive and far stronger than we little hippies thought. And we will need to be fighting this fight forever. Greed doesn't go away. And there are plenty of people who are willing to, you know, sell their own mother down the river for enough money. And they are more than willing to hold wars for money and oil because it makes perfect sense to them. It doesn't make sense to me.
Steve's calling from Boston. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, David. How are you today?
I'm good, man. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the call. I appreciate it. David, I can't say enough. I've seen you 45 times by now, wow, dating back to the 80s, three times on this tour, which was amazing. And I wanted to thank you so much for bringing What Are Their Names out of the archive. That was one of the most powerful moments of the entire tour.
It's a fun thing doing that because it's really true. We don't know who's running our world. We really don't.
It was a very, very powerful moment of the show. My wife Jamie and I have been friends of Graham's and Peeves for years, and as a result, you and I have gotten a chance to meet and talk on several occasions. And I wanted to give you a personal note of thanks, something that I finally got up the courage to tell Graham this year, which is that far beyond the causes that you personally believe in, you guys have sown the seeds of charity throughout the world. My wife and I started a charity here locally to benefit foster children. We just got done producing a concert with Maya Sharp, which raised $20,000 to reunite foster children who had been separated by DSS. My son Daniel, who's 17 and also a big fan, started an organization called the Massachusetts Children's Fund, which provides baby food to children who are starving here in Massachusetts. And as I told Graham, all of this happened because you and he and Bonnie and James and Jackson basically set out a goal for the rest of the world that you can change the world. You just have to have the courage to get in there and try. And
yes.
I've meant to tell you that to your face on many occasions. And
well, thank you.
I get very tongue-tied. I was with you in New York after the Madison Square Garden gig. And
Steve, you got it out, and we hear it, and we're glad to hear it. Do you take credit, David Crosby, for that?
Well, maybe some. Maybe some.
You deserve some. Babette's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Babette, you're on the air with David Crosby.
Hi, David. It's an honor to talk to you. I'm coming to you from Concord by way of Mill Valley. So I'm
Hi.
Sure that at one time we were neighbors. Hi.
Probably.
And I'm calling with a really immediate question and concern for you. My husband and I were bred on your music and the whole sensibility of the counterculture. Now we have a daughter in high school. My husband was actually a CO, conscientious objector, during the Vietnam War. And now we're seeing my daughter bring friends home, gorgeous, strong young men who want to be in the military. And
well, you know, that's a choice they can make. I can't blame them for wanting to do something to test themselves and something that will you know, bring growth to them. That's usually what it's about. They want to prove themselves and they want to grow. They want to grow up. They want to feel adult, you know, and the problem with it is that the expectation and the dream of going and being a Marine is different than the reality of going and being a Marine. And the thing to do anytime that you want to clear that up with somebody is show them the first 20 minutes of Private Ryan. Then if they still want to join the service, let them.
Babette, thanks for your call and good luck. David Crosby, can the country still look to music as a kind of social guide in the way that it did those decades ago?
I think so. I think it's been part of our job for thousands of years. You know, we were the town criers. We were it's 8 o'clock and all is well, or it's 11:30 and there's a chimpanzee in the White House and things aren't so good. That's part of our job. Troubadours. And I think it always has been, and I'm very, very proud that it still is.
And the job's getting done?
To some degree. It could be done better. You know, there's still a whole lot of people in the music business who never do a benefit, ever. Ever. That's hard for me to really get with. That's very hard for me to understand.
You're 65. What about your plans? You going to just keep at it all the way?
I'm going to do it until it's not fun. You know, I mean, I see people out there older than me doing it, you know, just fine, making good music. So, don't know what to tell you, you know.
You don't have to. I think it's in the music. I think we hear it already.
I when it's not fun, I won't do it. And that's, you know, that's all I can tell you.
Yeah. Well, so far, so very good. Listen, thanks for the new memoir since then. Thanks for the new 3-CD box set, Voyage. It's been great talking with you. David Crosby, thanks very much for joining us today.
You too, man. Thank you.
We go out with David Crosby's song, Dream for Him, written for his young son, Django, and performed here live by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The answers I know. What are you going to say?